to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Often called the Dean of Writers about the American West, Ivan Doig is the author of such national bestsellers as The Whistling Season and The Bartender's Tale. In his latest novel, Sweet Thunder, he reprises his beloved character, Maury Morgan, to take on the power of the press in an era of intense corporate greed and social unrest. The story takes place in Butte, Montana in 1919 and is a love song to newspapers and the countless writers, reporters, and editors who bring them to life each day. Again, the name of the new novel is Sweet Thunder, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ivan Doig to this week's Book Show. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Well, delighted to be here, yeah.
You're a newspaper man at heart. I assume that never really leaves you, does it?
I guess not. I did not spend all that much time as an editorial writer, as my Montana folks said, back east in Illinois, Joe, but it very much seems to have stuck with me. And when I began thinking about what Maury might be up to next in the next book, it seemed to me he would probably sign on with the Butte Thunder newspaper and try to take on the Wall Street might of the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, which pretty well had Montana in its grip there, 1919, 20, and 21.
Several things, I think, that are interesting in what you have written. And of course, first and foremost, with Maury as the chief editorialist for The Thunder, it gives us a perfect time to good versus evil, to look at that wonderful conflict that is always around. However, also of looking at newspapers and the power of the press, and obviously a question that still comes up of what is the power of the press and certainly the power of the daily newspaper.
Right. I decided in doing this, I would take Maury right back to what I and my journalism professor wife, now retired Carol, see as a bedrock principle of journalism and newspapers in particular. The old saying, to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And Maury outright says at one point in the book that a newspaper without principles is merely a sort of a collection of ongoing messy events. And so fighting for mine safety, living wage, trying to break the copper collar as Anaconda's grip on Montana and its politics and economy was called. It seemed to me that those were things Maury would find worth fighting for, and I think journalists long since have found worth fighting for in various venues around the country.
I found it fascinating that you wanted him to be an editorialist and not a reporter. So this is not an investigative reporter. He is going at it through the eyes of an editorialist.
Right. Maury is, above all, I suppose, a wordslinger. He was an unorthodox school teacher in a one-room school when he first appeared in The Whistling Season. And in the prequel to this book, Work Song, he is back working in a library and helping write a union anthem, things of that sort. Maury is chock full of things I'm not sure I know myself, Joe. you probably shouldn't admit that the character is smarter than the author, but Maury has this walking encyclopedia ability. He can function in Latin and a little Greek, as he says, as well as English, and so he will get an idea, and I have to dive into some of the Latin books I have around to, you know, get the translation, follow investigatively myself into what his ideas are. And so in writing him as an editorialist, it gave me a chance to have Maury really unleash his barrage of language at the ogre company, Anaconda.
You have some 15 novels to your credit, and the first Maury Morgan story debuted in 2006. What was it about this character, or I guess another way of asking, a follow-up to what you just mentioned, of when did you realize that this character was perhaps smarter than the author and and had a life that could go on beyond one novel?
Joe, you've undoubtedly been to the book signings and readings, and someone is always asking from the audience, where did you get that character? Is that character you or
right.
what?
Sure.
And very promptly, Maury about took over the floor. Questions about Maury took over the floor at these audience gatherings. People would say, I wish I'd had a teacher like him, or he reminds me of a teacher I had, or something of that sort. And I also remember, I'm usually up there at the mic firmly denying that I favor any character over any other or anything of that sort. But I do remember putting Maury down on paper when he arrives at a train depot in Montana and Homestead country in 1909, that he came to life immediately on my page in front of me. I could see what his hair was like. I could see what he was wearing. I could all at once hear him. The conductor of the train has confiscated Maury's brand new Stetson because he was broke and didn't have a plane ticket. And I think the first words out of Maury's mouth and out of my head were Maury asking his sister, Rose, what about my chapeau? And so immediately he's got a vocabulary, and he simply has been a character worth writing about and, I guess, reading about, according to the response of the audiences.
And a character, I assume, that you enjoy being with for the amount of time that you have to be with a character in the process of writing a novel.
That's true. He's very interesting to be around because, as well as being a bit of a rapscallion, I give that much away, he thinks about things. Things have happened to him, both good and bad. And so as a writer, and Maury is the narrator of these two Butte books, both Work Song and Sweet Thunder, he is able to put on page thoughts, ideas that it'd be difficult for me to get to if I was writing the impersonal voice of God third person. So Maury, sometimes he gets in a spot, he will lie flat on his back in bed and look up at the plaster map of the ceiling above and wonder, where should I go next? Is it Tasmania, or am I going to tough it out here in Butte? So there are things of that nature.
I'm hoping you can read a short passage from the new novel, Sweet Thunder, in which Maury talks about Butte and describes the landscape, which obviously plays such a large role in the novel.
All right. We have a minute and a half worth here, I think. Maury is up on the Butte Hill, always called the richest hill on earth, as you will hear. And he is looking around. He's up there on an errand. As I topped the last street rise and left behind the world of downtown Butte, the day was a rare one of winter clarity, the snow-held Rockies beyond the city limits dazzling in full sunshine, while the 30 or so mining operations in full swing along the hill stood out in every detail of black steel headframe towers and bin cars loaded with peacock shades of copper ore, squat red brick hoist houses throbbing and thrumming with cable work, the entire spectacle as if a gigantic factory had been thrown open for inspection. The richest hill on earth never ceased to thrill and chill me at the same time, with its powerful manufacturing of wealth, the squalid leavings of that, dump heaps like Sahara dunes and gaping bottomless pits called glory holes. And three times a day, the human equation came into stunning view. As shifts changed and miners and their legions poured forth to and from neighborhoods, gullied into the surroundings of machinery and dumps and pits.
That is Ivan Doig reading from the new novel Sweet Thunder, published by Riverhead Books. What brought you and ultimately this character to Butte?
Well, it took a deep breath for me. I'm from the other Montana, Joe. I describe myself as being from the Lariat proletariat part of Montana, the ranch country. My folks, parents and grandparents, both were ranch hands and ranch cooks. And so it's the rural part of Montana, small town part that I grew up in out there. And Butte, quite frankly, was a foreign place in several meanings of the word to us, because it was a city in its heyday back in the early part of the 20th century. Butte, in fact, was the largest city of the Northern Rockies. It's big enough, to, you know, straining every muscle to be metropolitan. The vaudeville circuit there drew in people like Charlie Chaplin and Sarah Bernhardt and Clark Gable. And it's always a stop for traveling politicians, on and on. And so Butte had a reputation as being rough and tough and full of attitude. I still think when I go to Montana, I can often tell whether someone is from Butte, because when they say the word, their chin comes up about an inch, you know, in pronouncing the word. So I had never thought I would write about a novel, a full novel about Butte. I've written about it glancingly in some of my earlier books. But I just decided to throw the dice with Maury, put him into Butte. And I have since spent, oh, I don't know by now, 3 or 4 years, I guess, living in the Butte of the past, in research, in book after book after book, in some places Google doesn't go yet or hadn't gone by the time I found photos, say, of the old Butte Public Library, kind of a wonderful Gothic extravaganza that absolutely captivates Maury. And I knew immediately I had put that in the book. And so by kind of getting myself by the scruff of the neck and saying, okay, learn a little something about these miners, learn why copper miners all around the world used to, you know, were so dazzled by the prospect of Butte and its wages and its 2,000 miles of mine tunnels under there with copper, that they used to say, don't even stop in America, just go to Butte. So it's captivating in some ways.
So in your research and in the history that you have explored, how common was an anaconda?
Well, anaconda was actually a kind of a, what will I say politely on the air here, some kind of a stepchild of the Standard Oil Trust. And so some of the same figures from the turn of the 20th century, Henry Rogers and William Rockefeller, who had pretty well cornered the oil market in the United States, began investing in Butte with the same notion in mind on the copper market. So this is the era, Joe, of the trusts. Ultimately, Teddy Roosevelt comes along and gains a reputation as a trust buster. The press takes them on and so on. But it was a day of colossal financial Wall Street baronage, and the miners' unions in particular that had pretty reasonable relationships before Anaconda was bought up by the Anaconda mine was bought up by these Wall Street interests. They found themselves slipping in influence and safety and wages and every other way. So I don't like to draw historical parallels, but in the long book that is history, this chapter doesn't look too unfamiliar to some others in our past.
And that's inevitable, right? I mean, it, in several ways, one being that I assume things like this are on your mind. You are a historian, so you think about what has happened and what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way of this story of corporate greed, which is certainly time honored, and what we were talking earlier about the newspapers, the troubles they're having now, basically looking at large business, which is now comprises the media as well.
Well, I think you have a good point there. I am a writer whose imagination lives somewhere decades away from me in the past there, I'm sure. But the atmosphere of my own times has to seep into me to some extent, I think. And so, yes, I think I am driven, pulled, what, by some of the feel of the current society. I will slip in quickly here that my first book, This House of Sky, was a memoir of my people in Montana, my father and grandmother.
Mm.
And I wrote that way back there. It came out in 78. Way back there, determined that, you know, if Spiro Agnew, the disgraced vice president, could get a book contract to write a novel, by gosh, I was determined to write a book about my family doing the chores as honestly as we could. So, yeah, there are some incentives in the air.
You, even though you had several careers and several different academic and career paths, there was always a point where you wanted to be a writer, where that was at the center of what you wanted to do.
Yes, hopelessly, from probably a senior year in high school, certainly. When that fall, I got on a train and went off to Northwestern University, enrolled in the School of Journalism there. And by my sophomore year there, I had sold my first magazine article, a very short one, to a very, very small magazine, probably. But yes, my life has been words on paper ever since. And so far, you know, ultimately, Joe, you keep at it long enough, the life turns into a living if you can get enough books out of you.
The idea, and I mentioned it in the introduction, of being this this writer that is so associated with the West.
Mm.
And certainly Montana embodies that. And what do you make of that, of our fascination with the West, for both people who live there and for the people who do not, and that notion of that its enormity and its power and its mystery?
Well, that draws a lot of readers. You're certainly right, you know, all the way from what the old dime novels of Ned Buntline and on through Zane Grey and John Wayne and so forth, I suppose. A lot of us, though, and I count myself very much in this, have written against what we see as the myth of the gunslinger. I've sometimes said, you know, the Louis L'Amour, John Wayne figures with 20, 30 pounds of gut held up by a couple pounds of belt buckle, that is not the real West. It is the West of school teachers and homesteaders, miners, corporate outfits like Giant Anaconda, and so on. And so I don't feel I'm purposely writing about the West. I feel I'm writing about that larger country life. And I happen to be from the West, born in Montana. I was in Montana until I went in the Air Force, college. I was away for college, but until I went in the Air Force after college. And I now live out here on Puget Sound. And so I'm simply doing what I think writers have long done, which is to write about their home territory. As Conrad wrote about the sea, as James Joyce goes off to Paris and Trieste, mm-hmm. And on, and what does he write about? Dublin. So I think it matters more where your imagination lives than where the writer seats himself.
At this point, your imagination lives in Montana. You now live, as you mentioned, in Seattle. So what brought you to even further west? And what was there a changing of the place or something that was missing, that a void that you wanted to fill elsewhere?
Carol and I were married and both had magazine editing jobs in Evanston, Illinois. And so Chicago and Northwestern, of course, our university is there in Evanston, the same Chicago suburb. We'd had several years of Chicago living, liked a lot of things about Chicago, but greatly missed things like mountains, access to the outdoors, things of that sort. And so we, quite a number of years ago, threw over those two magazine editorship jobs, got in a gunboat Buick, and as a lot of people have done in this country, pointed ourselves west, where I entered the University of Washington towards earning a Ph.D. in American Western History. And we never got away from Seattle after that. All my books have been written here with my imagination, and often the two of us, me with notebook and so on, and Carol with camera, revisiting Montana, going through Montana, looking at this, listening to that. And so we seem to have followed a compass that had a Western pole on it, I think, Joe.
Is it still true to you to write about Washington State?
Well, I have written a couple of books that take place out here on the coast. And my second book, Winter Brothers, does take place on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington. If I were starting over, if I had been born and spent more time out here, yes, I think I'd be known as, you know, the writer of the Grand Coulee Country here, or the writer of the state of Washington. By now, I have some 500 characters that I've invented spread across these dozen or 13 novels that I go back to. They're my population of my imagination, and they happen to be in the Two Medicine Country and Butte and other places in Montana. So I'm following, you know, huge footsteps, not particularly deliberately, but they're there. You have to notice them. A Faulkner writing time after time about his postage stamp of a county, as he called it, in Mississippi. There, Yaknapatawpha, and Thomas Hardy across the pond in his Wessex country. Again, using that home territory. It's like Joseph Conrad using the sea, I would say, that you go back and back to where you were young and your impressions were strong and you know how they talked and what happened, and you might as well write about it.
Well, the name of the new novel is Sweet Thunder. It is published by Riverhead. Ivan Doig, a great pleasure to have you on the book show. I can't thank you enough for being with us and sharing your stories and career with us.
You bet. It's a delight.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the novel is Sweet Thunder. It's published by Riverhead. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.